the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in place, what happens next?
We're looking at is a reconfiguration of a regional system where I would say that on the one hand, following the weakening of the axis of resistance in Iran, there is much more space for Arab players that want stability.
President-elect Donald Trump says he'll impose tariffs on the three largest U.S. trading partners on his first day in office.
But we're going to put a tariff on Mexico if they don't immediately stop sending that horrible stuff into this country.
Join us now on The Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news. I'm Scott Walterman in Washington.
I'm pleased to announce that their governments have accepted the United States' proposal to end the devastating conflict between Israel and Hezbollah.
There's relief over a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah, but Lebanese people are now facing the realization of the challenges that lie ahead. The U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement raises multiple questions. Will Hezbollah fully remove its fighters and arsenals from southern Lebanon? Can the Lebanese army ensure that it does? Who's going to foot the bill for rebuilding Lebanon? The World Bank estimates that Lebanon has suffered $8.5 billion in damage from the war. At the same time, Lebanon faces its own internal tensions, a long financial crisis, anger among Hezbollah's opponents who blame it for the war. Hezbollah is a designated terrorist organization by the United States and other Western nations, and its war with Israel started on October 8th, the day after Hamas's attack on Israel, has changed the dynamic in the Middle East. Joining us now to talk about that is Avi Melamed, a former Israeli intelligence official and author of the book Inside the Middle East, Entering a New Era. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us and talk about this.
Of course.
Tell me your first thoughts about the ceasefire agreement.
Well, I think that the ceasefire, in the end of the day, reflects the needs and interest of both Israel and Hezbollah to have a ceasefire for their own different reasons. The ceasefire for itself is quite sensitive sort of speaking, and it's very fragile, I would say. But roughly speaking, it seems that it has trajectory ahead in the sense that it will hold, because in the end of the day, it reflects interest of both sides to have this ceasefire. Obviously, each side walk away from this ceasefire, basically counting its own cons and pros, but this is a different perspective.
Well, I can see Hezbollah's side. You know, they've been really hurt badly by the war, leadership and materiel. What's Israel's, what do they walk away with?
Well, look, I mean, from the Israel perspective and from a military perspective, Israel can definitely mark some significant achievements. As you accurately mentioned, Hezbollah has been significantly beaten. It's interesting to note in that regard that in the Arab world, the overall notion vis-a-vis this whole Israel-Hezbollah collision is that Hezbollah has been defeated. And this is something for itself very interesting, because the Hezbollah positioned itself in the last couple of decades not only as the big power in Lebanon, but as a regional power, and to a large extent, basically not, it wasn't a baseless image. So the Hezbollah in the Arab world, there was shockwaves to see what happened to the Hezbollah during this collision with Israel, during this 1 year of collision, or a little bit more with Israel. So Israel, in that regard, can, from a military perspective, can definitely mark some significant achievement, particularly in the context of reestablishing or rehabilitating Israel's deterrence image that was badly crippled on October 7. On the other side, we still have to remember there are 70,000 or so Israelis that as for the time being are still refugees, the Israeli from the northern communities. They are not going back yet to the northern communities. There is clearly a discontent among those people who basically demand the government to continue full steam ahead and to totally crush Hezbollah. A request that to a large extent is not very realistic, I would add. And so there is a sense of like a sourness among Israelis. Those Israelis who says it is the sourness is because the significant military achievement, there was an expectation that the outcome, let's put it this one, will be much more dramatic in sense of like securing their future living along the Israeli-Lebanese border. So I would say that this is another aspect from what Israel is taking away from this situation. I think in the wider perspective, I would say that the most significant thing, I think that we could expect a totally change of mindset and policy of the next Israeli government vis-a-vis the threats that are being built around Israel. In other words, I don't think that we will see again a situation where Israeli governments will sit aside and will watch Hezbollah building its capacities in South Lebanon or Hamas building its capacities in Gaza. It's very clear that Israel will move on to act proactively, very decisively to eliminate this building threat on its early phases. So I think this is one of the major differences as an outcome of this war.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I know that a lot of people are also disappointed. You mentioned Gaza, that the Gaza ceasefire wasn't tied together with the Hezbollah ceasefire.
Well, yes, that's disappointment. You know, in a way, ironically enough, is common denominator between Palestinians and Israelis, or some Israelis, particularly Israelis, of course, who wants to see the Israeli hostages back home as soon as possible. So, in a way, it's kind of like ironically speaking, because this is the common denominator. The wish for a ceasefire. It's interesting, by the way, to say that from the Hezbollah perspective, Hezbollah launched the attacks on Israel on October 8. The leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, that was eliminated later on, he basically said, "We are doing this supporting Gaza, and we will not stop the war until there will be ceasefire in Gaza Strip." So now, there is no ceasefire in Gaza Strip, and yet Hezbollah agreed to ceasefire with Israel, which also, again, it's kind of like adding to the notion in the Arab world that the Hezbollah has been significantly defeated. Not so surprisingly, I mean, people in the Arab world understood that in the end of the day, this whole issue of Hezbollah taking Israel to support Gaza is basically nothing but a sort of an excuse to cover up other things. But in the end of the day, the bottom line is that when you look at that, at least from an Arab perspective, it's quite clear that they view Israel as the one that had the upper hand in the confrontation with Hezbollah.
Don't you think that also in the wider sense that all of the anti-Israeli alliance has been sort of exposed as a paper tiger, including Iran itself? I mean, Israeli intelligence has everybody's number dialed in, it looks like.
Well, look, I would put it this way. It's clear that following October 7 and everything that happened since then, today we can say that what we call the axis of resistance, namely Iran and its different proxies, particularly when we talk about Hezbollah and Hamas, major proxies in this Iranian-backed infrastructure that is called the axis of resistance, it has been significantly weakened. Definitely not in the same power it has prior October 7. And so this is something for itself very significant to notice. However, I would also mention, you know, it's not tiger made of paper, because in the end of the day, we should remind ourselves, I mean, those proxies, and let alone the Iranians, maintain a significant military capacities that can cause a significant damage. I mean, we are looking at huge arsenal of thousands and dozens of thousands of missiles and rockets and attacking drones. The Iranian regime is constantly engaged in building military capacities and delivering its military capacities to its proxies. And those military capacities are very harmful. They are very dangerous. So I wouldn't say tiger off paper. I would definitely say that, yes, they have been significantly beaten. Israel has been performing outstandingly, sort of speaking, in terms of intelligence and military capacities and technological capacities. But I would not undermine the Iranians and the proxies' harmful impact. In the end of the day, we have some examples. We should remind ourselves that unless Israel had the ability to successfully intercept most of the incoming rockets and missiles and drones that were launched by Hamas and Hezbollah and the Iranians, the situation would have seemed totally different. I mean, we would have been in totally different situation. So we should remind ourselves that is the right dimensions of the picture that we should look at.
Yeah, I know. I get what you're saying. What I was really thinking was, so the alliance of Israel and the Western countries that support them, Great Britain, the United States, and so on, stood fast and had the technology to repel, as you point out, the drone and missile attacks by Iran. And when it came to the end of that volley back and forth between Israel and Iran, Iran stopped firing weapons at Israel, so that they would not engage directly the United States and the other Western powers. The same thing with the other proxies. You said that, as you pointed out, Hezbollah says we're going to fight until the war in Gaza is over, and they didn't. Hamas has been pretty much decimated. Hezbollah has been pretty much significantly reduced, if not decimated. And so the other players in the region, the other Arab nations that are also where Iran is also a thorn in their side, sees that at the end of the day, while they have a lot of weapons and they have the capacity to cause a lot of trouble, they are not what they said they were.
Look, there are different aspects here. Let us remember that Iran attacked Saudi Arabia and caused Saudi Arabia significant damage in a relatively short attack a couple of years ago. So we should remind ourselves that, yes, that is correct, that the Arab players in the region who are threatened by the Iranians and the axis of resistance definitely are not shed no tear over the defeat of Hezbollah. They shed no tear over the decimating of Hamas, and of course the fact that Iran has been facing some significant pushback. That is for itself a very significant achievement. Remember, of course, that one of the significant equations that was changed during that year is the one that up until now, the Iranian regime was actually in a win-win situation, meaning he was activating its proxies at will, but he was totally exempted from any repercussion. Now, for the first time since the Iraqi-Iranian war, Iran has basically directly attacked and sustained some significant damage on its soil following the Israeli retaliation, following Iran attacks on Israel on October 1st. So this is something that has been significantly changed, and this is significant. And as you accurately said, you know, the Arab regional players who are concerned with the Iranian threat, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, obviously are satisfied with the fact that the axis of resistance has been weakened. But that, again, they do also remind themselves that the Iranians and their proxies can cause a significant damage. And so, for example, if you look right now, you know, the Saudis are continuing their dialogue with the Iranians, even kind of like in a more smiley way, not because they know exactly who's their neighbor are, but the Saudis understand that in the end of the day, Iran is in the region. It's a significant player. It has a significant ability to cause damage. So the Saudis are aware of that. In other words, what we are looking at is a reconfiguration of a regional system where I would say that on the one hand, following the weakening of the axis of resistance in Iran, there is much more space for Arab players that want stability. There is much more larger room for maneuvering and space for proactive approach that will serve their need in stability. And that will be at the expense of Iran's hegemonic vision. But on the other hand, they will still continue to find way to conduct, conduct a productive dialogue, let's put it this way, with the Iranians. And so I think this will be part of the reconfiguration geostrategic landscape of the region.
All right. Thanks so much for the perspective. And we'll talk again soon when the new administration starts to take shape and Middle East policy has the potential for that change as well.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Avi Melamed, a former Israeli intelligence official and author of the book Inside the Middle East, Entering a New Era. You're listening to Issues in the News on The Voice of America. I'm Scott Walterman.
So we lose 300,000 people a year to drugs entering from Mexico. And if they don't stop this poison from flooding into our country, and they can stop it by not accepting it from China, and I'm doing the same thing with China, we're going to tariff the hell out of them.
President-elect Trump making good on one of his biggest campaign promises. He says he will do so on his first day in office. He's threatening sweeping new tariffs on the three biggest suppliers of goods to America. We get details now from AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Trump says one of his first executive orders on taking office would be imposing a 25% tax on all products from Canada and Mexico, and an additional 10% on goods from China. It's part of his bid to crack down on illegal immigration and drugs, but it's unclear just how serious Trump's threat is. The tariffs could dramatically boost prices for Americans on everything from gas to vehicles. A U.S.-Mexico-Canada free trade deal forbids any member from just imposing tariffs on another. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum suggested that Mexico could retaliate with tariffs of its own.
De los principales exportadores de México, Estados Unidos, son General Motors, Stellantis, y Ford Motor Company.
She's saying she was willing to engage in talks on the issues, but said drugs were a U.S. problem. VOA's Lori London and I talked with Inu Manik, a fellow for trade policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, whose expertise is in the international political economy, U.S. trade policy, and the law and politics of the World Trade Organization.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this.
Absolutely.
So President-elect Donald Trump Monday pledging big tariffs on the U.S.'s three largest trading partners, Canada, Mexico, and China. What exactly does this mean?
At this point, you know, we're looking at what tariffs are and what they do. Tariffs are a tax on imports. And who pays those taxes are the importers. So that's American businesses that buy inputs from other countries or American consumers that are buying things from abroad. So at the end of the day, a tariff is a tax, and that is what President-elect Trump wants to impose on the U.S. economy. What this means in terms of what he's going to do is unclear. When you look at his tweet, he doesn't state how he's going to do it, how it's going to work, whether there'll be exemptions. So at this point, I think he's just trying to lay out that he wants to take some tariff action, and he's identified some of our top trading partners as the targets of that.
You know, in the tweet, he says that he's targeting Canada and Mexico and China because the three of them allow migrants and drugs, particularly fentanyl, to come across the border, and that he's going to put the tariff on until they do something about it. I don't ever remember tariffs being used like that. Tariffs have been used to protect an industry, the steel industry. Foreign steel is too expensive. We're going to put a tariff on foreign steel so American steelmakers have a level playing field. Do you know of a case where tariffs were used in a political sense like this?
Yeah, I think President-elect Trump is certainly expanding the use of tariffs as he did in his first term in office. And this is to deal with issues that are unrelated to trade, right? And this is an expansion of presidential authority on trade that I think is going to be largely unprecedented in what we're going to see in the next 4 years. So the tariffs are not going to stop the flow of fentanyl or anything across the border, as even people. And the way to deal with those things is through cooperating with our trading partners to figure out what we can do in terms of cooperation on the border itself to address these issues. And that's going to be screening things that cross the border, whether it's things and people. And that's not something that we can do with tariffs. So that's just a misguided approach to dealing with the problem.
Mexico is our largest trading partner. Is that because so much is manufactured there?
Well, it's a mix of different things. Part of it is manufacturing, which builds into the U.S. manufacturing base. So there's a lot of American value added in the things that Mexico produces because we have American companies that invest there. The other reason Mexico has become our number one trading partner is because of our trade war with China. In fact, we had a lot of trade diversions. A lot of things that we normally would get from China, we now get from Mexico. And that's the effect of the original Trump trade war tariffs against China.
Like what? Like what kind of goods?
So we'll be getting some machinery and other intermediate products in manufacturing, certainly food products. And we've seen shifts in terms of overall flows of different traded products that have come through Mexico from other partners in Southeast Asia, like Vietnam as well. So a lot of trade has kind of moved around over the last few years as a response to avoiding the tariffs.
So what do you see this meaning for the U.S. and potentially the global economy as a whole, if this were to be imposed, these tariffs were to be imposed?
I think for the United States, this would certainly have an inflationary impact. Canada and Mexico being our top trading partners, we would see right away, I think, an impact on this for the average consumer. We would certainly hurt our relationship with our two most trusted trading partners, which I don't know is a good idea for us to be doing that, particularly when President Trump actually renegotiated the NAFTA agreement, which was the predecessor to the USMCA, which he called the best trade agreement that ever been done. So now he's threatening actually to destroy that agreement by enacting tariffs that violate the spirit and letter of that law. So I think it bodes pretty poorly for the way the United States is going to cooperate with trading partners and get anything from them if we simply can't be trusted to abide by the rules that we negotiated ourselves. So a lot of uncertainty, I think, for the United States and the rest of the world.
This also is going to affect, you mentioned it briefly, the automobile industry. A lot of cars are made in Mexico, and it's going to affect Europe if that happens, because a lot of European cars, Volkswagen, BMW, I think Mercedes, are made in Mexico and then shipped across the border into the United States.
You know, certainly, the auto market will definitely be affected. This is one of the most integrated markets within North America. And you have to really be willing to ask, are American consumers going to want to pay 25% more for these products? And you think about the way that production works in automobiles. We have parts that can cross the border multiple times before it ends up in the final automobile that's assembled. So every time that part crosses the border or certain parts cross, you're actually adding a tariff on that. Now, that's going to be really costly. So it's going to end up being more than 25% at the end of the day, and that could really undermine our competitiveness.
A lot of people do believe it's a bargaining chip.
Definitely. I do think this is typically what we saw during his first term in office, where he would use the threat of tariffs or the threat of withdrawing from an agreement as a way to get our partners to the negotiating table so that we could get something and extract concessions from them. So I do think that's how he's using it, and we have to wait and see what he's actually going to ask for, and then whether our trading partners are willing to give that.
It is the art of the deal.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Thanks so much for the insight.
No problem.
Inu Manak, fellow for trade policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, whose expertise is in the international political economy. That's it for this week's edition of Issues in the News. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending the time with us. For more information throughout the week, you can listen to our podcast, The Issue, which drops at 2200 UTC on our website, voanews.com, and wherever you get your podcasts from. Join us next week for more Issues in the News in Washington. I'm Scott Walterman.